Hello, it's Tom Slater here, editor of Spiked. Before we get into this episode of Last Orders, I've got a really exciting announcement for all of you. Spiked is officially in the books business. We're delighted to be partnering up with John Wilkes Publishing to produce a series of books all about the maddening times we find ourselves in. And we couldn't have picked a better one to start with. How Woke Won, the latest book by Joanna Williams, will be published on the 19th of May. You can pre-order your copy right now. Just search for How Woke Won on Amazon or go to spiked-online.com/books. And to celebrate its release, Joanna will be joining Brendan O'Neill for an extra special live Zoom edition of his podcast on Monday, the 16th of May at 7 p.m. Spiked supporters can join them for free. If you're a Spiked supporter, you can claim your ticket now from the supporters hub. And if you're not a Spiked supporter yet, then sign up today. You'll get free access to this event plus other exciting perks. Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up and claim your ticket. Tickets will also go on general sale next week for £5 if there are any remaining. Thanks so much and see you all there. Welcome to Last Orders, the Spiked podcast all about freedom, the nanny state and censorship. In this episode, we discuss Elon Musk's takeover of Twitter, the rise of state censorship, calorie counts on menus, and the calls to slap graphic warnings on alcohol. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked. I'm joined today, as I am every month, by Chris Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Tom.
And we're delighted to be joined, return guest to the show. Third appearance, I think.
Oh, maybe. Yes, that, sounds about right.
That is the voice of Andrew Doyle.
Hello.
Known to many of you, I'm sure. GB News presenter, satirist, comedian, and the author of Why Free Speech Matters and a new book, Andrew, yes, which is coming out later this year. Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
That is called The New Puritans, and it's coming out in September. And it is about this new ideological movement that is very much comparable, I think, to a religious movement. And I'm talking about the way in which it borrows from a sort of religious traditions of the past, the more puritanical, fundamentalist types of religions. It makes sense of it, or it helps me to make sense of it anyway.
Sounds great. So when's it coming out?
September.
September. Mm-hmm. So everyone should look out for that. Can they pre-order it? Is it online?
Why not?
Brilliant. So let's talk about what is really the biggest story in the world right now, and that's saying something given there's a war in Europe and everything, is Elon Musk buying Twitter. He's instantly sent most of the people on the kind of top tier of Twitter, if you like, into complete meltdown. Certainly the worst meltdown since the last one, at least. People threatening to leave, people talking about it as a dark day for democracy. And in large part, really, it's because he's threatening to make it less censorious than it has been previously. Not much else to it other than that. Andrew, what's your kind of read on all of this? And what was your favourite meltdown?
Oh, well, I mean, it's difficult to know. There have been some quotes from people working inside of Twitter, and apparently there are people are freaking out about this, and there's tears and tantrums and everything you would expect. Sean King's was interesting, you know, the activist Sean King,
and famous ally of Black Lives Matter.
Yes, yeah. he said Musk's takeover is about white power. He says Musk is upset that Twitter won't allow white nationalists to target and harass people. But again, you know, all of these activists, they tend to know what's going on in people's heads, apparently. And that he thinks that this is why Elon Musk is taking it. It's not. I mean, you know, Elon Musk is quite clear about why he's doing this. He is concerned about the censorial drift of this, which is the de facto public square. It's important that they don't boot off people for ideological reasons, which is what they currently do. And so, I don't know whether Musk is going to make any difference. Probably not. I'm enjoying the meltdowns. I'm really enjoying the tantrums, because the whole of this movement is just so fundamentally infantile. It's about people who can no longer reason, discuss, debate. All they can do is cry and throw insults and stamp their feet and threaten people. That's all they have. And this just proves it, you know? And so that's why it's great that these people are outing themselves and flouncing off Twitter even better.
It has flushed out a lot of them and flushed out a lot of the kind of pat arguments that used to be trotted out. So, you know, Twitter's a business, just go to another business. But as soon as someone else buys it, they go
to that's it. Used to say Twitter is a private company, can do what it wants. But apparently that doesn't count if someone owns it who they don't like. You know, it's like you say, it's flushed out the authoritarians. And I honestly don't know whether any of this will help, but there are some things that Elon Musk could do that would really, really help. And they're basic things. Mm. He could make sure that there is a clear terms of service on the site so that you know explicitly why you're going to be banned, you know, so that the rules are absolutely clear, rather than the current situation where people get kicked off, they appeal, and they get an automated response just saying, we've kicked you off, you can't come back, you've broken the terms of service. You ask why, they come back with the same, you've broken the terms of service. It's this Kafka-esque sort of trap. Where you've committed a crime, but they won't tell you what the crime is. That could change. If he was serious about this, that could change. And I think that would be a good thing.
It's interesting as well, because you almost see some people very late in the day kind of clocking onto what a problem it is, just having one person essentially in charge or ultimately responsible for all of these kinds of rules. There was one particular clip, I think it was on MSNBC, we had this contributor who was saying, the thing is, ultimately, now he can decide if he doesn't like these candidates, if he doesn't like these newspapers, if he doesn't like these individuals, he can just shut them off, or he can just turn down their... It was almost like it was slowly dawning on them. But
that's what's happening already.
Exactly.
Yeah, it was all the double. He was specifically saying they could do this before an election. They could get rid of a major media outlet because they don't like the stories. They're telling, they could, couldn't they? Well,
imagine if that happened.
The Hunter Biden one's interesting because Musk has explicitly commented on that. Yeah. And that, you know,
there's no one shut cakes or anyone.
It was mad. I mean, the New York Post, you couldn't share the link to the article. The New York Post's account was locked out. And it turns out everything they reported was almost certainly true.
Yeah.
But you know, it was as close as election interference as you can come, really, I think. And it's weird, isn't it? Now they're realizing, this could happen to our preferred candidates. You know, it's not rocket science.
Chris, are you hopeful about Elon Musk's Twitter if it does actually end up happening in the end?
Yeah, I am a bit, because I think it means Donald Trump will come back on, which is all I really care about in life.
The greatest tweeter of all time.
Exactly, yeah. So presumably that will happen. If it doesn't, then it'd be very disappointing. You know, we're used to getting these small wins along the way, and then you end up being disappointed. So it could happen again. I agree, Andrew. I don't think it's going to fundamentally change. I think they'll stop, you know, banning the New York Post from telling the truth at election times. And they'll let, you know, Milo Yiannopoulos and Donald Trump back on. But the idea that it's suddenly going to become a wash with Nazis or something is just very far-fetched. In fact, there was a Guardian article explicitly said that it is already a cesspit, a cesspool of Nazis, Twitter. I mean, I just haven't been seeing much of this. Maybe I'm following the wrong people. But yeah, every now and again, very, very rarely, I will see somebody with like Nazi iconography in their profile. Incredibly rarely. And I'll much more often see like Mao or Stalin or someone like that. And even that's pretty rare. I don't know. Maybe there are loads of Nazis out there on Twitter, but I don't come across them. And if I did come across them, I'd ban them. I'd block them. So why doesn't everybody else? Everyone keeps going on like the edit button. We've already got a block button, which is much more important. I mean, an edit button would be a bad idea for different reasons, but you can just block people, curate your own timeline. Yeah. I know there are nasty people out there saying horrible things, but if you block them, you'll never hear from them again. It takes 1 second to do it. So I don't see the issue with that. What are you going to say?
Well, it's just, I mean, I saw today there was one tweet that went viral. It's this guy, Jeremy Newberg. I don't know who he is, but he was a blue check on Twitter. And he screenshot a Nazi account. It's explicitly swastika, using racial epithets sort of thing, and saying, this is what we can look forward to. And then you look at the account. Well, for a start, the account's gone. It's already been nuked. But it had 12 followers. And it was like, you know, all you have to do is block it.
Yeah.
This person, he's gone out of his way to find it.
Yeah.
Posted it. And amplified it, right? So to prove this point.
And it may well be a troll account anyway.
You know? Almost certainly. So, I mean, it's the problem is solved. The block button, weirdly, is how free speech on the platform is preserved, because you can just block out anything you don't want to hear. And it works, and it's great.
And people come up with ideas to make that experience easier. If you really just want to live in your own echo chamber completely, you could do that, I'm sure, with your settings already, but maybe make that easier. But it is just, it has been a sort of moral panic. It's interesting that so much of the discussion has been about disinformation or content moderation, which seem to me they're just euphemisms really for censorship. Because like you say, with the Hunter Biden example, to treat that story, which essentially ended up being true, as misinformation, was putting your thumb on the scale. It wasn't about, you know, quack cures that were circulating on the internet or whatever. But the meltdown, just go back to it a second, it is interesting because it was like with Brexit and Trump. I think Thomas Frank referred to that as like a democracy scare.
Yeah.
And this was like the clearest one we've had yet of like a proper free speech scare. Like they're genuinely terrified of the prospects of it. It really, it's the flip side of all of that. The way they talk about it, it's actually like they think free speech and democracy are like a threat to civilization.
Yeah. But also, they catastrophize, you know, everything, right?
Yeah. Okay,
Brexit and Trump, they were big political events, but they were exactly the same about the prospect of Channel 4 being sold off. They were the same about the Daily Mash being, or the Mash Report being cancelled.
You mean everything? You see that Labour MP in Parliament who got up and said, what if Elon Musk tries to buy Channel 4?
Very good idea.
Two moral panics coming together.
But like, yeah, you get this every few days. One of the things about Twitter, isn't it? Is people, generally speaking, on the left, absolutely going crazy about something that's not actually that important.
Is this getting worse? Because it's a form of hysteria.
Yeah,
it's madness. I mean, for the book I told you about, I was reading a lot about Salem and what happened in Salem, and you know, the more I read about that, the more I can see that there were people involved who probably knew it wasn't real all the way through it. There's a really good story where the girls who were calling everyone witches, they went to Andover and they accused a local dignitary of being a witch, and he said, "Well, I'm going to sue you then for $1,000 or whatever it was," and they shut up and they withdrew it. And everyone just let it go. So there were people who knew it wasn't real at the time. But then I watch the current hysterias now, and whether it's Channel 4, Elon Musk, the explosion of irrationality that you see from people who are major commentators or politicians or in the public eye, I think some of them must know this isn't real. I know that human beings always have had this capacity for groupthink and hysteria. I know that. But just looking at this stuff, it feels like it's worse than it ever was.
Yeah. Definitely. And I think, you know, you go from one hysterical spasm to the next.
Yeah.
You know? But I suppose one thing about this which feels a bit different is that, and it's particularly striking because a lot of this is the kind of American political class and intelligentsia, is that they genuinely think free speech is a kind of byword for fascism in a way that like an idiot student would about 10 years ago. And you'd be like, shut up. What a ridiculous thing to say. They do genuinely believe that.
Do they? Do you think it's genuine? I don't know.
I think it's the way in which they kind of, because it's interesting in America because there's been so much panic about, you know, you read out the Sean King tweet about he's going to allow hate speech on the internet. Free speech doesn't mean hate speech. They live in a country in which you cannot censor hate speech on a kind of legal level.
Yeah.
I feel like the reason they get so obsessed with the social media thing is, and through these companies and who owns them, all the rest of it concerns them so much, is because that is how they kind of outsourced censorship.
Mm.
And now that's being challenged. Now one of many institutions they control has been taken away from them. They can't handle it. So I think, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of bad faith, there's a lot of hysteria, there's a lot of hypocrisy and all the rest of it. But I think free speech does like scare them genuinely. And probably because it's about allowing people to answer back.
I'd love to talk to one of them, one of the ones who post these hysterical things, people like Sean King. I'd love to, but they would never
Jamila
talk.
Jamila Jamil.
I'd love that.
Podcast.
But they will never talk.
Yeah.
They just sort of screech into the internet. And I like to have faith in humanity and faith in the sort of our capacity to reason our way through things. And then you see stuff like this I find it very dispiriting.
It'd be interesting as well to see if he can actually change anything, just because you kind of see the response from the people inside Twitter. And now, you know, and also the response you'll get legally. Obviously, we've got the online safety bill over here. The EU is passing legislation. Even the Biden's White House is talking about setting up some sort of panel to look at disinformation.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, the idea that he's going to have total free speech on Twitter is obviously untrue because of the law. And he said himself, he's obviously going to obey the law. Yeah. The law differs greatly between different countries. Britain's becoming one of the worst ones, really, in the so-called civilized world. And so, he's going to have to go along with the online safety bill and whatever the Americans come up with. So I don't see Twitter fundamentally changing their terms of service very much. They're just going to allow people to say things that are legal but offensive to
able to get away with misgendering people again.
Well, you just allow a former president of the United States to say what he thinks within the law, things like that.
What an outrageous proposal!
And the Babylon Bee to do their
I think that'll come back, and those sort of things could actually change. The other thing that a lot of people are talking about is whether there will now be transparency about what they have done up until this point. You know, I remember when Jack Dorsey admitted that there was a shadow banning thing. You know, we know that still happens. They just don't call it shadow banning. So maybe, and there's lots of suggestions that with Musk in charge, all of that stuff might come out. And that's maybe why people at Twitter are panicking so much.
I've been seeing people a lot in the last few days saying that they've been shadow banned. And is this true? There seems to be an element of moral panic about this as well. Because I see people, I've just been shadow banned. Well, I see all your tweets all the time.
Yeah.
So the other day, somebody replied to a tweet of mine and somebody replied to him saying, did you know that you've been shadow banned? And he said, what's that? It means that no one can see your replies. I'm going, well, I saw his reply. You obviously saw his reply.
The problem is that there are various sites that tell you if you're shadow banned, but those sites are inaccurate.
Right.
So people start thinking they've been shadow banned. But we all know that you can all see, if you look at any Twitter thread, that there are a number of replies that are hidden. and you have to click on a thing to click through. They say these are some replies that may be offensive.
Yeah.
And when you click through, they're never offensive. What they are, in fact, are accounts that have been flagged by Twitter.
Oh, right. So that's all it means. So that's just to turn up in that bottom.
Right. So there's part.
Well, that's the bit I go to first. But
so it's partly that they deboost, and there are certainly ways in which Twitter can there is evidence that Twitter have manipulated.
And they've said it explicitly. Misinformation stories, they'll explicitly say we're suppressing the spread of this particular link.
But you're right. People then make assumptions just because their tweets aren't getting as many retweets as they used to, and they'll
Nigel Farage, for example.
Has he said that?
He said that he used to get 5,000 retweets for every tweet, and now he only gets 300 or something.
But so he might just.
It's like nothing to do with Brexit outing and then becoming less relevant to political.
So what we don't know, do we? This is the point. It could be that. Yeah. That's a good example. So it could be that his tweets just aren't as popular as they once were. Mm-hmm. It could be that it's not out of the realms of possibility that Twitter are manipulating certain accounts, because they do flag certain accounts. Happens to James Dreyfus all the time. He gets his accounts deboosted, and he's just an actor making a point about the reality of biological sex. But this is my point about transparency. We just don't know.
Yeah.
But this might be interesting if Musk or can release, I imagine some of the minutes of those meetings.
Mm.
Yeah. And you know, it sounds conspiratorial, but then, I saw a clip the other day of an Amazon meeting, a meeting among the heads of Amazon, which has been leaked somehow. And they're talking about a book that they found problematic. It's the Matt Walsh book about a book aimed at children about Johnny the Walrus. Do you know about this one? So, there's all these woke children's books about gender identity. Right. He's written a book about a young child who says he's a walrus, but the adults say, well, you must either now commit to being a walrus and transition to being a walrus, or you must accept it. So it's satirizing that. And Amazon have now flagged and said, it's a really bad problem that the book is selling so well and we need to do something about it. And this was leaked. So these corporations do have these conversations. Abigail Schreier's book, you couldn't find it on Amazon for ages. It's not a lie to say that people in control of these corporations manipulate accessibility to these various things. We know that's a common tactic of this ideological movement. You know, when archivists at Homerton College in Cambridge were uploading their children's books into the digital sphere, there were various books like Little House on the Prairie and stuff that they now consider racist, and they prevented people from finding them. And they openly said this. They said our job as gatekeepers is to prevent people from seeing offensive material. So that's part of the mindset.
You search for it directly, but you wouldn't come up in the kind of, people who like this book. Like this book or?
Yeah, exactly. So you wouldn't find, I think Abigail Schreier's book didn't even come up in searches for a while. There was something going on there. I mean, and when that only needs to happen a few times for people to, and there's proof of it, for people to start thinking this or seeing it everywhere.
Yeah.
Which you have to be guard against as well, But I think I think there could be stuff that Musk could do to, I think transparency is all. Like, how about, if you violate the terms of service, firstly, have the terms of service clear, so you will expect to be banned. And then you get an email explaining why you've been banned rather than an email just saying you're banned.
Yeah.
That would be a really massive improvement.
And even something as modest as that would terrify people by the sounds of it. But, you do wish that all of this wasn't contingent on your favourite billionaire owning the platform.
Of course.
But that is unfortunately the nature of it, isn't it? We should talk about some other censorship stories, non-big tech censorship stories. Just there was this case in recent weeks which we wrote about on Spiked, which really kind of reminded us about how bad the problem is in the UK in relation to state censorship, effectively. We spend a lot of the time talking about cancel culture and people getting sacked and people getting booted off their Twitter account. But it's still the fact that periodically you still see these stories of someone being either narrowly escaping prison, as happened in the case we're going to talk about, or actually going to prison for basically just saying offensive things on the internet. So this is the case of Paul Bassetti, who's a sort of property tycoon from Southeast London. People remember this story. It was in 2018. He was at a bonfire night party where his friends had built this effigy of Grenfell Tower, all very dodgy by all accounts. I mean, there was little black and brown figures in the windows. Yeah. He was taking a video of it in the background. You could hear people making racial comments and all the rest of it, racist comments. He sent this video to two WhatsApp groups, and then a video, they're not sure if it's his video, ended up on YouTube. It went viral, and he ends up handing himself into police as a result of all of the outrage. So finally, he went to court. He ended up being acquitted. Then it was again pursued again, and he's ended up with a 10-week suspended prison sentence under Section 127 of the Communications Act. Andrew, we've seen a lot of stories like this. I know you did a documentary for Spiked about the Count Dankula case, which is not too dissimilar. But do you think people realise that this stuff actually goes on? Because obviously these things, people write about them, but they're not really that widely discussed. No. It's quite uncontroversial, this kind of censorship.
The trouble is when I mean, there are people who still don't know what happened with the Dankula case, for instance. The Grenfell one has been widely reported, but the problem is because he seems like such a wrong'un, and because it's obviously distasteful, and there are very few people who wouldn't see that as distasteful, then people don't seem to care. But actually, they ought to care, because someone's, well, suspended sentence, like you say, for a joke. But I think we have to move beyond that. Even if it were the case that he was just saying hateful things explicitly, not through the medium of humour, he should still be able to do that. You know, we have to support free speech, particularly for those who we don't approve of. Mm-hmm. That's the problem here. And again, we come back to this point of, if you support the free speech of someone unpleasant to say unpleasant things, you are invariably accused of supporting the thing they say. And we just have to move beyond that. And you know, I think there needs, but the, you know, I come back to this again and again, but we just need to scrap the very concept of hate speech laws, and we need to repeal Section 127. I don't see any appetite in Parliament to do that.
Well, it's interesting, actually, because the online safety bill will get rid of bits of Section 127.
Right.
So the grossly offensive thing is going to go, but it gets replaced by something which could be even worse, called harmful communications offence or something like this.
That's the language of social justice, isn't it? Exactly. That words are harmful. Just words are
kind of one step forward, one step back on that particular issue. But Chris, what did you think of this particular story?
Well, if it's illegal to be grossly offensive, then I guess he broke the law, you know, but I don't think it should be illegal to be grossly offensive. And I think there is a perfectly respectable, and this maybe not the right word, but there is definitely a strain of kind of gallows humour and dark comedy, particularly in Britain, where people do make jokes about, you know, the Twin Towers or Madeleine McCann or whatever. People do, and it's often on bloody WhatsApp. Most of the stuff on WhatsApp is absolutely rubbish anyhow. So this wasn't like this was broadcast on the BBC. It was just some bollocks video on WhatsApp that people kept forwarding to each other because it's too easy to forward things on WhatsApp. I seem to remember watching it at the time, and I would even defend it up to a point on the basis of, while it was burning, there were people saying, do not leave your home, do not leave the flat, which I had forgotten was part of the thing. They actually told people not to leave the tower, didn't they? The authorities. So I think you could even defend that as being satire up to a point, you know, and making a bit of a political point. But you don't, like Andrew says, you don't need to defend it on any basis. You should be allowed to be grossly offensive, in my view. It doesn't matter whether people find it funny or not, or if it has a particularly, you know, savage political point to make.
I mean, we don't know what were in their heads as they were doing this. I mean, I think in the video that went viral,
they were
viral,
just trying to be really offensive in the way people do.
But, you know, someone was saying packy in the background, all this sort of stuff, which I think gives it a certain,
well, it makes it worse, obviously,
indication of what they're up to. But as you say, we shouldn't really be in the business of looking into men's souls when we're talking about these kinds of things, especially for something that was going on in someone's back garden. And the WhatsApp bit is actually quite interesting, because there's a lot of cases like this now. There was one a year ago where two men actually went to prison because one of them did this like racist, seemingly racist rant about Priti Patel. Whether it was in jest or not, I don't know. But he, again, sent it to a couple of Snapchat groups, I think. Not WhatsApp, but similar, kind of private. Someone sent it on to another two. The bloke who made the video and sent it got 10 weeks. The bloke who just sent it on got 6 weeks, I think, in prison for doing this. And this is an increasing thing. Is, you know, in essence, that's sort of private speech even. You know, they're not standing up and saying this in public. And yet even that can end up being criminalised if it manages to get out on the wider internet, as so often is the case at the moment.
But that's why we need to defend the principle above all that, because these are the discussions of distractions. What you say, Chris, about, you know, should we analyse the satire? Was it effective satire or was it just hateful? Whatever. It doesn't matter. Like it was the same with the Dankula thing. A lot of the comedians who wanted Dankula to go to prison, apparently, they said, well, he's not funny. It's not funny. It's not, and therefore it's okay for him to be criminalised. Mm-hmm. It's nuts. Like, we just have to say, even hateful things you should be able to say if you want to.
Did either of you see the BBC Mary Whitehouse documentary? I bet you did.
I didn't.
Didn't you see it? No. Oh, you must watch it. It's very, very good. It's very interesting because, apart from anything else, if it had been made 10 years ago, it would have, clearly the whole theme would have been, look at this silly old bat, right?
Yeah.
Now, I wouldn't say it was sympathetic or saying she was ahead of her time, but it was quite sympathetic in some respects, particularly with regards to her campaign against pornography. There was people on there going like she was actually took a pretty sound feminist line on this. Mm. But it was much less disparaging than it would have been if it had been made 10, 15 years ago. But what it reminded me was that in that period in the very late 60s, early 70s, when they basically got rid of a lot of the censorship
Yeah.
A lot of filmmakers, people like Ken Russell, went crazy for it, didn't they? And there was, and the same thing happened in the 80s when you had home videos and you had a video nasties. Yeah. You had what were in the main awful films, but they were just going out of their way to push the envelope as far as they legally could, which was quite a long way. Even including like the soft porn, you know, Confessions of a Window Cleaner, all that kind of stuff, right? It was all rubbish, you know. And the whatever the film version of 120 Days of Sodom was called, Salome or something.
Oh, I know, yeah. The Pasolini.
Yeah, all this was, it was clearly designed, the devils and things. You know, they were all designed to be grossly offensive, basically, to disgust audiences, to shock the public. And people who were fighting White House's campaign made a very strong defense of, well, that it's artistic. And you might not, you might say there's nothing very, you know, meaningful in some of these, you know, the cannibal Holocaust or something like that. Yeah. But people have got a right to do it. And if you're shocked and offended, that's part of the point, if anything. You know, that was the argument made against people like Mary Whitehouse. And it's kind of disappeared now, hasn't it?
Well, I think in a way, it's, the internet has sort of changed it, because even the types of people, intelligentsia, cultural set, who'd feel very comfortable making a case for artistic freedom, well, you know, you might not like it, but artists should have the right to provoke and all the rest of it. The difference now is it's not the people who manages to get exhibited or the people who manage to get a film out. It's anyone has a smartphone can broadcast to so many people, and that shits those people up as well. They don't want Oix being able to, you know, make jokes that they might find distasteful. And also they don't give those people the benefit of the doubt that they would in other situations. Right. You know? So it's almost like, because the internet has been a genuinely positive democratizing sort of, you know, thing in so many respects, because it does allow anyone with this device in their pocket to be able to broadcast to everyone. It's really tested people's commitment to free speech, and so many of the kind of previous sort of liberal intelligentsia have flopped as a result of that.
Because people would say, well, Ken Russell or whatever, he's some Scandinavian auteur. He's clearly making some very clever point. This horrible film about coprophiliacs, whatever. Yeah.
but that, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned the Mary Whitehouse point, is that, you know, her view was that mass media corrupts the masses, corrupts the plebs, right? Mm. And that was the entire basis of her argument, which is the current argument of the identitarian left, right? So they have the same basic. But look, either nasty films create violence in the real world or they don't, right? That's the question we should be asking. And they, all of the evidence tells us that's not the case. Therefore, that should be the end of the discussion, and people should be able to make whatever art or even trash that they want to make, you know? And of course, invariably, important works of art get folded in among and dismissed as trash and all the rest of it. You know, apparently Cannibal Holocaust is quite an interesting piece of work. I don't know. But something like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, for instance, which I think is a spectacular film, to the extent that I can't watch it. I find it so disturbing, I can't watch it. But, you know, that's what I mean, is that we have to have the discussion about mass media consumption and whether it leads to violence. And then we have to have a secondary conversation that if it is the case that that's true, which it isn't, but even if it were, would that be grounds for censoring anyway? I don't think it would. In other words, I think we keep having the wrong conversations.
Yeah. And we've almost been had the luxury in recent years of arguing whether, you know, a feminist should be able to say that only women have vaginas, such as those things are so bad, you don't end up having to have the hard arguments about, you know.
One of the things people used to say to Mary Whitehouse all the time, quite understandably, was if you don't like it, don't watch it.
Yeah.
And in actual fact, she didn't watch most of the stuff. She complained about it. But that still rings true today.
Yeah.
If you have to go out of your way to search for, you know, the burning effigy video on YouTube.
Yeah.
Isn't her argument for pornography that, you know, pornography creates rape in real life, which is the same argument of radical feminists today, but the evidence tells us it's the opposite.
Yeah.
So you know, the fact that we have evidence, the fact we have studies, we have data we can look at, why are all these debates being conducted on feeling and hunches, you know?
I suppose they always have, is the lesson that on some level. We should move on to other things that people say are bad for us, and that's some of the nanny state stories this week, Chris. I want to talk about calorie counts, first of all.
Yeah.
So as of the 6th of April this month, under these new government rules, restaurants which have a certain number of staff now have to display the calories for each of the items on the menu.
Yeah.
Chris, do you want to tell us a bit more about this? When did this come in? What do you think about it? Are you a fan?
It came in at the start of April, I think. I have very mixed feelings about it, because I don't mind having the information. And actually, since it's come in, I've been to a couple of pubs where they've had the calorie information, and it is quite appalling how many calories there are in nearly anything you want to eat.
Like, you're scandalised.
Well over 1,000 in most of the things that would tempt me. So I find it in a way quite hard to believe it's not going to have a bit of an impact on people in this in the positive sense. If you're trying to lose weight, you've got this information in front of you. But I mean, Andrew just mentioned the evidence there. We have a lot of evidence on this from other countries, America mainly, where they tried it and it hasn't made any difference. It doesn't make any difference to what people buy. And in this pub I was in, where we had a bit quite a lively conversation about it. We all bought what we're going to buy anyway. Mm-hmm. We just discussed it earlier on. Now, there's an argument to say that this will just make people feel bad about it. So they'll still have the fry up, but they'll feel guilty about it. So that reduces their consumer surplus or what have you. There's an argument about people with eating disorders, which I think is a very tricky one. They, you know, certainly don't like the idea and been against it since day one. So I don't know. All I would say is it's by far the most benign part of the government's obesity strategy. I mean, the rest of it's going to come in over the course of the next year or so. The ban on buy one, get one free comes in October, just as inflation is predicted to hit 9%. So that's good timing. And the cost of living crisis.
Joined up.
So I'm fairly ambivalent about it, in all honesty. But in principle, I suppose I'm in favour of it because it gives people information. I'm in favor of people having information. And if people are genuinely or have been genuinely buying the mixed grill, assuming it had like 150 calories, then maybe we can fix that information asymmetry. But the evidence suggests that actually people have a pretty good idea that even if they don't know exactly how many calories are in the food product, that it's not, you know, it's got more in than the celery.
Yeah. It was quite funny finding out that in most places, like the kind of dreadful sort of like vegan alternative to whatever the burger is much more calorific.
Oh, really?
It also shows you how few calories are in McDonald's, because McDonald's has been doing the calorie count for ages. And even if they didn't, you know, there's always in the newspapers about how many calories. And it's like the Big Mac is portrayed as being like the most energy dense thing you can possibly buy. And it's not at all. You know, it's actually competes pretty well with most things from a Green King pub or whatever.
Although their milkshakes are incredible.
That's where they make up the difference.
If you get a large milkshake, it's basically your calories for the day.
Yeah.
It's insane. It's over 2,000 calories.
It's basically ice cream, isn't it?
With sugar in there as well and all sorts of things. Just, and cream.
I think someone did a comparison pointing out that like most prep sandwiches are more calorific than your average McDonald's.
Yeah, it's really burger, you know. The thing I like about it is seeing a few people on Twitter shocked that the stuff they thought was healthy actually has less calories in it.
Shouldn't it be the case, though, that restaurants should be allowed to put the calories on if they want? If they, you know, I mean, I don't mind seeing them. But I think it's
a lot of places already were as well. You know, like always the Weatherspoons app has had them for some time.
It's the compulsory thing that I suppose is the issue, isn't it? Like,
it is. We do it. We have the same thing with food in supermarkets. And to be fair, it's not compulsory, but that's just because the government couldn't do it because the EU. But the government would have done it compulsorily.
Yeah.
It made it mandatory. And I don't think, I mean, does anybody object to calories? Would you object to it being the law from a shop?
I'm with you in that I like to see what the calories are. I didn't know, for instance, that if you buy a packet of corn cocktail sausages, it's massive calories. But if you buy the corn smoky ham slices, there's hardly any. So there's a bit of a tip there for any vegetarians trying to lose weight. Just eat the ham slices. But like to know is good. I agree.
I kind of agree,
We should move on to something that I think maybe you'll be more animated by, Chris. So there's been this study from the University of Stirling about graphic health warnings for alcohol. So this has been an idea that's been doing the rounds for some time, obviously following on from cigarettes and tobacco and all the rest of it. Do you want to tell us a bit more about this story?
It's basically the same people who produced all the junk science for plain packaging and indeed for graphic warnings on cigarettes. Just doing exactly the same thing again. Trying to get graphic warnings and presumably eventually plain packaging for alcohol. Now, you may say that after what I've just said about calorie labeling on food, I shouldn't be against warnings on alcohol. And up to a point, that's true. But these graphic warnings are never about giving people information. All right? The information people need to know about alcohol, they already know, which is like if they drink masses of it, they're going to get liver cirrhosis and they shouldn't drive and they shouldn't drink when they're pregnant. This isn't about that. And it's the same with tobacco. That it's not about giving people information. It's about revolting them. It's about deterring them, not wanting to look at the product that they've bought. And so what they did in this study, it was an online survey, which is a typical methodology these days in public health. They did an online survey of 18 to 35-year-olds and showed them what a Smirnoff bottle would look like with a text warning saying, you know, drinking kills, and what it would look like with a graphic warning of somebody holding a pretty lame graphic warnings, actually. It was like someone holding aside, you know.
And of course, and they said, well, do you think this is makes it more or less appealing? Do you think this makes it more or less socially unacceptable? That was a giveaway that they're asking people about the social acceptability of alcohol, not like, oh, does this give you more information? That wasn't one of the questions. Do you feel better informed about vodka as a result of seeing this? Wasn't even asked. And obviously people said that the less attractive bottle is more attractive than the, you know, sorry, is less attractive than the normal bottle. Obviously, they said that. They said exactly the same thing with plain packaging. But we know now, because we've got the evidence, that plain packaging didn't make any difference. And, of course, people feel that the plain packs don't look as good as the normal packs. That doesn't mean if you're a smoker, you're going to stop smoking and change your packs. And it doesn't mean if you're a non-smoker, you're any less likely to start smoking. So we know this stuff doesn't work, but I suspect this is just one of dozens of studies that are going to use the same methodology, and eventually it'll all be in a systematic analysis and it'll be stuck down at the Department of Health, and they'll say, right, we've got overwhelming evidence here that we can reduce the number of alcohol-related deaths if we start putting diseased livers on vodka bottles.
Do you think it's going to happen? Do you think it's going to come?
Eventually, everything happens, doesn't it? I mean, eventually.
I don't think it's kind of
delay and oppose it for a while, but there's it's a one-way ratchet. You know, Boris Johnson, the great libertarian, is bringing in all this rubbish about food.
It's definitely not going to work, though, because everyone already knows the consequences of excess alcohol consumption. That's just the truth.
Well, I suppose everyone already knows the consequences of excess food consumption as well. But anyway, time will tell. Chris, Andrew, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.